Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM. Talkspace.com/boom. B-O-O-M.
You are Locked On Warriors, your daily Golden State Warriors podcast. I am Daniel Ruhr, your host, and so happy to bring you your team every day. This is actually the last time this week that I have a spot that is not a game review due to the games against the Pelicans, had Adam Lauritsen on, then the Mavericks and the Nuggets in that road game. So I wanted to finish up the Reddit mailbag, and the way that I'm going to approach this one is I'm also going to include some other kind of inputs, if you want to call it that, because one of the issues that I got, I opened up on the podcast last time when I did the Reddit mailbag, was the idea of explaining bird rights, and there were a few people that reached out, and so I'm going to give a very short explainer of how this works with a Warrior-specific tilt on it. If you need more information, you can check out the CBA Encyclopedia or many of my other works, but I'm going to try to get it in like a, the goal is 2-minute audio form, just so you have it. So if a bird rights are an exception to the salary cap, and they're designed so that teams can retain their own players. So really, you can use cap space to sign guys if you want to do that. You don't have to follow these rules if you're going to go that direction. However, bird rights are an exception, so they're a way to stay over the cap, which is why that matters in terms of Durant and Steph Curry and everything else like that. So the first kind, you get these in stages, is non-bird. And so you get non-bird rights, it's a misnomer, but you get that when a player has been on a team for one season. And in that case, like Durant, like David West, like Zaza Pachulia this year, you can pay them either a 20% raise on their prior salary, the first year salary, or you can pay them 20% raise on the minimum salary. And the reason they do that is just kind of to protect it in case, you know, a guy's getting paid a really low wage or something like that, just to make sure. And in that circumstance, you can give them that. You can only pay them for 4 years. You can't give them that big 5-year contract. But the reason why this is notable for Durant is because on his current contract, he only has a 4.5% raise in there for the second year, which is not as nearly as much as a 20% raise. However, the reason the non-bird distinction matters is because 20% might not actually be enough to get him to what his abstract maximum would be, whether they raise the rules or because if the salary cap goes up, because he's jumping what's called an experience tier, because he will be going from 9 years of experience to 10, and that allows you to get to a higher proportion of the maximum. So that is the sacrifice specifically that he would be willing to make. And it's also why it will be hard for the Warriors to retain, particularly David West, using non-bird rights, because they can only give him a 20% raise. And that is not very much when a player is playing for the minimum. So that's 1 year. If you get a second year, then you can sign a player for up to a 75% raise on his prior salary, or you can give them the estimated average player salary, which is a complicated math thing, but it depends really on how much everybody got paid over the prior year. Examples on that would be like Lance Thomas of the Knicks. He had a really cheap salary, but he'd been with the Knicks for 2 years. They offered him a 4-year contract at the estimated average player salary, which was started at about $6 million. He ended up taking it. The benefit of early bird, there are two big ones. One is that you can give the player that more money, and then the other one is you can give them 7.5% raises per season, which, you know, that can be a meaningful difference if you're talking about a player with a lot of money. However, a very interesting thing with early bird is that you cannot sign a 1-year contract with it. However, if you are an early bird, you are also a non-bird, so you can just use that, but you don't get the added flexibility. That's actually what was a big question mark in terms of LeBron James, because James, with the 175% raise, couldn't get to his, like, with the 175% raise, he could get to his highest maximum salary because of the big cap jump, but with 120%, he could not. And that's why he took a 2-year contract with Cleveland as opposed to a 1-year to kind of keep it rolling along. So you have all that. That's kind of the precursor to full bird rights, or Larry Bird rights, however you want to call it. And that is when a player has been on a team or on that contract for 3 years. So, like, for example, James Harden, when he got traded right before he was going to go up for his rookie extension, they were able to pay him using full bird rights because he had been on that contract. So if a player has full bird rights, you can sign them for any duration, 1 to 5 years, and you can start them at any amount up to their maximum and give them up to 7.5% raises. And that's the gold standard in that. That's what Stephen Curry will get if he re-signs with the Warriors. And that's what Klay Thompson and Draymond Green. That's what they used when they re-signed. And so it's really the centerpiece of the NBA's player retention model. So really that's how it works. You have those three stages and you work through it. And so a player like Durant, assuming he stays on the Warriors, will probably go through some stages with that. And the reason why most guys try to wait at least a couple of years to get their big contracts is just because you can sign a longer term deal, you can get bigger raises and everything like that. And the rising cap colors it a little bit for Durant. And so he'll have to make the decision in terms of whether non-Bird is enough or whatever his full max is. And we won't know that math until the new CBA comes in. And then even we won't really know the final numbers until we get the real projections next July. But we'll have a pretty good idea. So that's something to keep an eye on. And as many of you know, this is one of my things. So as soon as the information kind of comes out there, it is something that I will share. So to bring back the Reddit mailbag and some of the stuff that we've talked about before, first question is from Kemba17, which is, what player that the Warriors lost during the offseason should we be missing the most right now? And the biggest options with that would be Andrew Bogut, Festus Ezeli, Harrison Barnes, and Leandro Barbosa. It's probably a more complicated question just because of the fundamental of how are we dealing with Festus Ezeli? Because if we're kind of assuming improvement and everything like that, and if we were assuming full health for everybody, I feel he would have been a bigger contributor than he had been the prior years. He's such a wonderful talent, and he was really growing his game, and defensively he was kind of becoming something better. And Bogut was starting to wear down due to injuries and everything else. We're seeing a little bit of that downside with the Dallas Mavericks, but he's still a wonderful player. However, you can't really say Festus Ezeli at the moment credibly, considering he hasn't even been able to make it into a game for the Portland Trailblazers. He's still dealing with some knee trouble. So considering all of that, It's Bogut, because they don't have anybody who can do what he does. And that's an additional factor, because he would have been a nice piece with their overall rotation, you know, with David West, with if they were able to retain Zaza Pachulia, you know, to have another body in there who has a clear strength. And that fills a niche that they just don't have anybody who can do right now. Barnes would certainly help, but there wasn't really a realistic way to do that. Same kind of with Ezeli. They actually could have chosen Ezeli over Sean Livingston. I totally understand why they didn't, considering the value point guard play and what we're seeing in terms of the uncertainty with Ezeli's health. So it is Bogut, but it is an interesting question. And also, I'm sure they would love to have, you know, more of those fringy bench guys like Mo Spates, like Leandro Barbosa, because they would have a role in this team. But Ian Clark has done a good enough job, and they have enough kind of bites at the apple at center that I think they're okay with not having Spates, even though he would have helped this team. And Spates made the choice, so he could have done whatever. I'm sure the Warriors would have been happy to pay him the same price that the Clippers ended up paying him, though I'm not sure I've ever heard that definitively. I'm guessing somebody else has, so they can share that if they have. Next question is from Deputy Kovacs, and that is, how much longer will Klay's three-point shooting need to continue before it becomes a real worry? And there isn't really a clear number, but the biggest thing that you want to kind of keep an eye on is that there aren't any mechanical problems. And so when there aren't mechanical problems, like maybe he's not jumping as high, or one of his arms has a hitch or something like that, generally then you're already in the range of it being an anomaly, just being bad luck, something like that. When you see somebody change something, when something is different, then you can start to lean towards, oh, this could be a pattern, this could be a trend, this could be something greater. I would say probably around a month, not a month from now, but a month from the real start of the season. If it's still persisting then you start to think about it, and then another 2 weeks or so, it becomes a real concern. But even against the Pelicans, it looked better. And also something that I've noticed is that he looks more comfortable on his deep twos than he did before. He had one where he was kind of on the baseline, which was very analogous to a corner three. It was just a little bit closer, and his shot looked absolutely fine. He took it with complete confidence and everything like that. So it would be surprising if that were the case to really be concerned, especially considering the track record. I think Coach Kerr said last night that his first 20 games he struggled last year. I haven't really gone through a minute by minute of when his shot came back last year, but it was, you know, it was some point probably around that late November range, and that certainly does make sense. The next question is from Anton Delfino. This was one that I was really intrigued by, which was, create a 12-man roster using four players each from the Run TMC we believe, and strength in numbers Warriors, who's on the roster, what would the rotation look like. I'm not going to go too much into what the rotation would look like, because I found that to be a more complicated and kind of unnecessary part of the exercise, but it was really fun to put together the teams. And the author of the question clarified that he meant with the strength in numbers Warriors, he meant the Kerr Warriors, because one of the big questions was, how does Kevin Durant fit into this? So I'll start though with the earliest chronologically. With Run TMC, you have to start with the first three, with Tim, Mitch, and Chris. No matter what you really want to do with the rest of the team, those are all talented players that were the best guys on that team. The fourth spot was really complicated because you need big men kind of more generally, but I'm such a big Sarunas Marshalonis fan. I grew up kind of watching that Run TMC team and always thought he was so talented. So I would lean towards just having a few smaller guys and just playing with him anyway and kind of making it work from that direction. And I'm also considering this with those guys at the time. And so, like, when you're dealing with that team, it's more like the big men are like Alton Lister, and I'm not the biggest fan of Alton Lister. So you're not really looking at who became better over time, who became worse, because you're really looking at it during that duration. And Run TMC was short enough that you can really kind of work within that. So I would go Hardaway, Mullen, Richmond, and then Marshalonis, just for my own personal happiness and enjoyment. We Believe is also interesting just because those guys overlap so much with the current team, with, you want to call it the strength in numbers team, you can. Baron Davis and Steven Jackson to me are pretty much non-negotiable just because they were so good on that team and they were central. And again, like kind of the Run TMC guys, having them on the team, Baron playing point guard, Steven Jackson as an underrated defender who, you know, could hit open shots when he had to. Those are both things that you want to have, and that a successful team, if you were building a 12-man roster, would be good, even if they're not as central as they would be, as they were on the We Believe team. The last two spots get more complicated because some would probably say Monte because, you know, he ended up being, you know, being more successful, and kind of that off-the-bench creator would be nice to have. But again, you have a lot better point guard depth, so it's not that big a deal. I think that in many ways, the next guy is actually Andres Biedrins. And the reason for that is that he's a true seven-footer. He was still doing well then. I mean, Biedrins on those teams, those were some of his best seasons. So you're not really going outside of that kind of a norm. And so he brings something you don't have otherwise. And he actually would fit in reasonably well as being like a 15 to 20 minute a game guy, kind of in a way doing something similar to the Zaza Pachulia role with the current Warriors. And there's a reason why I use the current Warriors as the model. So I'm going to go with him. And then the last spot is really Jay Rich versus Al Harrington. It's a tough choice for a lot of reasons. I'm going to go with Richardson. I think that he would fit so well if you're using the current Warriors as the foundation, which they would be, to kind of just fit in with that system and fit in with those guys. And his athleticism would add a different dimension. And just I think he would just fit in so well with that. No qualms with those who would go with Al Harrington, because he's a talent and another guy who would fit in really well. I mean, you could think of Harrington in some ways as being a kind of proto Mo Spates, but just, I would say, better overall than Spates was. And so you could definitely see a way that would work with this team, especially considering the comparatively weak big men. And then, since the author of the question clarified that it includes Durant for the Warriors, it's really, really close for the modern team to being non-negotiable, because Curry, Clay, Draymond, and Durant are the guys. You know, they're the four best players. As much as you could consider Iguodala and Bogut just because of their importance to this team and everything like that, if your goal is to make the best 12-man roster, it has to include Kevin Durant, just straight up. I mean, Kevin Durant's an MVP candidate, having a phenomenal season. So the question of who would start gets into some kind of some interesting ground. And if we're talking a single off game, then the whole Draymond at center thing is not a problem. And I would probably go Curry, Clay, Chris Mullen, Durant, and Draymond. I think that would be a really fun lineup. You think about how hard this current team is to defend, you could go in that direction. And then you would have really good defenders off the bench with guys like Steven Jackson, and you could go in that direction. There are a few kind of other ways that you could do it. You could go with a traditional center like Biedrins, like the Warriors are doing this year, or you could go with, you know, kind of maybe you could go with Mitch if you wanted a little bit more size, or you could go with kind of more another small guy. I would be intrigued against some opponents to just play Steph and Barron together, or play Steph and Tim seems a little bit smaller, but Barron could guard some twos. But it's a lot of fun to think about, and that team would just be so watchable. I would be interested to see if you're taking three specific years, because like all those guys that I chose all play together on specific teams, to see how some other franchises could compare with that, just because so much difference in players and quality and all that over time for a franchise that was largely awful in all of the gaps between there. So I had a lot of fun doing that. It was a fun little exercise. The next question is from Genius Envy. Was there ever an explanation as to why the Warriors didn't run more Curry Clay screens in the finals? I never heard one explicitly. I don't recall anybody ever asking Kerr, but I believe that it probably related to Curry not being totally right physically. You don't really want to put a guy in the circumstance where he's taking bumps and everything like that in that sort of a circumstance. And also, I don't think the Warriors were as concerned, especially considering Steph wasn't the greatest at attacking switches in that series, about just switching that. Kyrie can use his size relatively well. He's not the biggest guy in the world, but he can do an all right job on Clay. And then JR for a couple of seconds can hold Steph, especially when he was limited. So I think it wasn't as effective as it has been the rest of the time and will continue to be into the future. But it is something that I agree that it was underutilized in the finals and maybe in the playoffs a little bit more broadly, though Curry's health could be a real mitigating factor there, but not only because he couldn't take advantage of it as much, but just because that puts some risk on that knee and everything else, because you can get knee-to-knee contact on a screen, and also because teams were being, as they always are, very physical and can use that span, especially Cleveland, who generally plays pretty big dudes on the guards, especially when Amon Shumpert is in the game too, because Amon Shumpert will just kind of run through him a little bit, give him a bump, everything like that. Next question is from 530 Farm. With all the talk about rim protection, I feel like our pick and roll defense is just terrible and seems to be having miscommunications constantly, allowing the defense, I think he means the offense, to get easy lanes. What do you think the reason for this can be? There are a couple of big ones, and I was happy that this question kind of came in, because I am in agreement that the bigger problem is pick and roll defense, not rim protection, partially because they have rim protectors on the roster and pick and roll guys. It's just about who they play. There are a couple different things that are leading to it. One, the communication issue, which was talked about in the last Reddit mailbag, missing Andrew Bogut, everybody else kind of getting used to their roles. Kevin Durant's a new addition, a lot of other smaller ones like Ian Clark actually playing a bigger role and things like that. This team is more different than some people think. David West, Zaza, of course. And the other big part of it is physical limitation of the big men. And so what the Warriors have done more broadly over the last few years is that they've kind of liked the big man to hang back a little bit. And what you can't do in that case is what the big man has to be able to do is stop the penetration when it comes. Sometimes you're conceding, especially deep twos, you're conceding 2-point jumpers, but the idea is that you're going to stop that guy if he tries to come at you. And Pachulia and West just haven't really, first of all, they don't really have that skill set as much because they haven't had that role as a pick and roll five where your job is really to hang back. David West started his career and played almost his entire time as a power forward, and their pick and roll coverages are often different. And Zaza Pachulia, the issue is more a physical limitation, just that I don't think he can get there as well as Bogut did. And Bogut, he had his limitations defending out in space, so he just wouldn't. And Pachulia doesn't really have that comfort level. He doesn't really have that physical capability yet. And that's also part of the reason why some of that could get a little bit better with time. The communication element definitely will. And Pachulia just knowing where to get to execute their defense will probably be there. Because it's not like Andrew Bogut was the most adept guy, but the part that won't probably get better is that Pachulia is not a great deterrent right now at affecting the guy when he chooses to drive. And so I think that's something we will see a little bit more often when they execute the scheme as they have previously done, that guard is just going to go after it. Tim Frazier did this a little bit against during the Pelicans game, and I think we're going to see it more moving forward, and that's a concern because there are so many talented pick and roll ball handlers in the league, and so they're going to have to figure that out. But as I've said ad nauseum, but it's still important to repeat because I keep on getting concerned, emails, tweets, all that sort of thing. I don't think the Warriors are going to be playing traditional centers all that much in the games that really matter, in the 10 to 15 games in the playoffs where they're facing the most talented opposition, because then they can go with Draymond and Durant at the 4 and the 5, and all these problems pretty much go away unless those guys get into foul trouble. So it is a regular season concern. I am not downplaying it in the slightest. but it is probably more of a regular season concern than everything else. So the next question is long, but I'm going to kind of condense it down a little bit. It's from NXXKX. I cannot pronounce that because it is all consonants. But really what they were getting at is the idea that the Warriors are over the salary cap, but they're still below the luxury tax line, and that this team is kind of limited. So the idea is really like, could they have done more than they did to bring back players? And the answer is mostly no. The reason why is because they had to sign Kevin Durant with cap space. So they had to get really, really close with cutting down their non-guaranteed guys, getting down the cap holds. I think off the top of my head, including the rookie scale guys, they could really only keep two or three like slots open for guys to pay them more than the minimum. And that was what led to an idea that I fully credit to Nate Duncan, my podcast partner with Dunked On, of the idea of using early bird rights, which I talked about a little bit earlier, to give kind of balloon payments, if you will, to James Michael McAdoo. And I'm trying to remember who the second guy is. So there were two guys who they had, I think it might've been Barbosa, who had, they had bird rights on. And so in that case, what they could have done is they could have paid them that higher amount, which was the estimated average player salary. It's about $6 million. And basically you turn them into human trade exception. And so the idea then would be that you could combine them and get somebody worth a bigger salary. But there are two big, big problems with that. One of them is you need the players to get on board, and yeah, they're getting a lot more money, but you would probably, in order to retain their value as it being human trade exceptions, would have to be a second year that's non-guaranteed, would have an early guarantee date, but there's that kind of uncertainty. And the idea of being a player who, yeah, you're making more money, but if you like being on the Warriors, you're basically being signed to be a trade asset for someone else, and you wouldn't be allowed to come back to the Warriors because of the way the trade rules work. So I don't think there's much to that. You can sell them on the money part of it, but the human element of that is really hard. And when you consider that Bob Myers is a former player agent and knows how all of that can work, it totally makes sense for why they didn't want to do the, let's call it the cold and calculated idea that Nate thought of and I fully embraced. I think that it makes sense that they wouldn't want to do that. And so if you take that off the table, then really what the Warriors were dealing with was minimum salaries and the room mid-level exception. And they did reasonably well with that. You know, David West was a very good pickup. He also happened to have his best game last night. Zaza Pachulia is a reasonable one. I'm going to go into a little bit later about the idea of who else they could have gotten with the room exception. And the other minimum guys, they did a good job. You know, they retained Ian Clark. They, you know, just kind of brought back, you know, floater guys. JaVale McGee was a nice pickup. Mike McAdoo's fine. I didn't support the Anderson Varejao signing, but, you know, I'm not going to be too mad about the 14th, 15th man's meant spots on the roster, considering everything and considering they could basically still have about the same options they had before if they, let's say, nudged him into retirement, because as the author of the question mentioned, they're still under the luxury tax line by a large margin, which means that if they want to, if there's somebody on the market that they really, really want, they can just cut somebody and add. And it would depend on who that would be and everything else like that. I think Larry Sanders is kind of the pipe dream, but, you know, whoever, if it's a buyout candidate in February or something else, they can try to make that work. So I think they did a pretty good job, realistically, and the idea of kind of getting trade assets and manufacturing them in that way always felt unlikely, even if it was a very smart idea. So I think they did a good enough job there. And that is also an important part of why you want to hit on your draft picks and why you want to hit on your minimum salary guys, because they really are kind of plugging holes, filling gaps and everything else like that. And, you know, it took Miami 2 years. That second year is when they got Ray Allen, when they really started to figure a lot of that stuff out. And or maybe it was the second year they got Shane Battier. I can't remember the exact order of it. But anyway, that was when they, yeah, the second year, I think, was Shane Battier. They did well to kind of fill that. And the Warriors are going to benefit, in all likelihood, from a higher middle-level exception next year. So if they can do the over-the-cap route with Durant, if he signs non-bird, they'll get a little bit bigger of a mid-level exception, and the amount of that is going to go up because it's fine. It's going to be adjusted based on, instead of being outpaced by these big cap rises. So I explained that a little bit last time. If anybody has any questions on how that works, just let me know. But I think they did. I think they did a reasonably good job overall. Next question is from D. Musinek. Do you think that there's anything structural, new players, offensive sets, that is causing Clay's current shooting struggles, or is it just an extension of his usual streakiness? Early on, it did feel like there were a little bit of an adjustment just getting the ball in the right place, and there was also some overpassing, just guys just kind of wanting to do that. But over the last week, it has just been streakiness. He's getting really good looks. They're just not falling. Some of them fell against the Pelicans. Most of them did not. Seemingly none of them fell against the Lakers, but he is getting good looks. And when a guy is getting good looks, even if the system is a little bit different, it's streakiness. You can't really blame the system for maybe his corner threes are a couple steps to the left or to the right of where they were before. But the system is fine at this point. And he's getting those looks. They're just not falling. They, in all likelihood, will eventually fall. So that part of it is not a really big concern. The next question, I'm just going to ask this because it's fun. Uber Troll, was there any reason why Curry was not able to expose Kyrie Irving in last year's finals, or due to I underestimate Kyrie's defense? Stephen Curry was hurt. He was dealing with a sprained MCL. He was not 100%. However, it should also be noted that Kyrie can be an underrated defender. His biggest issue on that end is actually more of something like, I guess you could call it apathy. And players are never really apathetic when it comes to the NBA finals. So we saw that in game one of the 2015 NBA Finals before Kyrie, he got hurt in overtime of that. He ran into Clay. That was Kyrie's best defensive game of his career at that point because he was really engaged. He really cared and he did a nice job. And so I think you do have to play both sides of that coin. Curry wasn't himself, but Kyrie did a better job and he was given a lot more to do than I think many of us expected just because Amon Shumpert was so far out of the rotation, because you can kind of make other things work with if you played Shumpert, put him on Curry, especially last year when he was such a central part of their offense. You know, you really put your best guy on Steph and you made it work that way. And so that was different. And of course, then they ended up putting LeBron on Draymond and kind of ended up capturing the pick and roll in that way as well, because LeBron could switch, he could do a lot of different things and could fall back. So There has to be credit given both ways, but you have to mention the injury as well. So next question is from 514S. Within the next few months, do you see the Warriors becoming Durant's over Curry's? I know they're unselfish stars, but there always tends to be an alpha. I don't. It's a hard question just because a lot of that is about the personality of the team. And the personality of the Warriors has always been, in the modern era, has been kind of a mix of Kerr, Draymond, and Steph. It's not really that stereotypical, if you want to call it, I kind of think of it as a football mindset of, oh, it's this guy's team. That hasn't really been this Warriors squad. I mean, they're a little bit more fiery than Curry is, but they do kind of take his professionalism and getting it done attitude as well, which is, you could say, is more in line with Kerr. Kerr kind of vacillates between Curry's personality and Draymond's depending on the moment. Incidentally, he got a little Draymond when Curry got fouled in that game against, crap, I can't remember who that was against. It was one of the recent games at Oracle where Kerr got a quick T and, you know, said, oh, that was OKC. And so, you know, he has those moments as well. But the team has a feel like that. In terms of the basketball, Draymond said, and I included this audio in the recording yesterday, that he feels that the offense is going to look more like what it has the last couple of years once Durant is fully integrated, once the other, like the big guys are integrated. And that makes sense because the overall philosophy of ball movement and player movement fits this team arguably better than it fit other teams. And so Durant will get his ISO possessions. He will get, you know, he'll get that kind of stuff, especially because he's so good. But the idea of forcing mismatches and then attacking them and busting up seams, which are really kind of central to what the Warriors have done the last few years, Durant fits perfectly with that. I think that's a big part of the reason why he chose to join this team. So I fully expect that to be a major part of where the Warriors go in the future. So it'll take time. I think I had to ballpark this before and say something like around Christmas or New Year's would be kind of the early test, and it could be as late as early February to really see this integrate all the way. But it certainly does take time. And from a personality perspective, I think what the Warriors are kind of going to do is the idea of having different guys step up at different moments. And it can be weird just because that central figure like Michael Jordan in Chicago can work well because then it always focuses around them. But the Warriors have made the multi-head approach work. Andrew Bogut was a very vocal leader for last year's team. Andre Iguodala has his own kind of leadership spot within this, and he's, of course, still there. And we'll see if David West can get in there too. But the Warriors have had a different mentality on that for basically the whole time, even when Mark Jackson was there. And I would expect that overall dynamic to continue. Next question is carnivorous shrimp. I like this question. Well, I'm gonna kind of answer it one way, which is, given how Zaza Pachulia and Dwayne Dedman have looked so far, do you think the Warriors would have looked better having signed Dedman for basically the same contract? And there was somebody else, I can't remember exactly where it was, in that asked about Nene. And those are really the three high-profile guys who all signed for the rumored level. They all signed for about the same money. I believe Dedman got a player option for the second year. Pachulia did not, probably because he didn't want it, and I can't remember what Nene got. And if you take the idea that the Warriors really needed a guy to fill part of that kind of 40-minute gap in the playoffs and just somebody to also fill in the regular season, knowing what we know now, I feel like Dedman would have been the best fit. Dedman has the highest defensive ceiling. He also has the lowest offensive floor, but the defensive ceiling is the most important thing for this Warriors team. He also would have been kind of enthused to grind out some of those minutes in a way that Pachulia and Nene were not. And the other reason why I would choose him over Nene, I think Nene has been number two on that list, is that he brings something different that would have been good for the Warriors. You know, like, Nene is a good passer. He can be a nice defender at moments, a good post defender. So he's probably the most versatile, the best all around of those three. But he overlaps a little bit with West in a way that wasn't particularly helpful. And Dedman fills a spot on the team. It's part of the reason why Warriors fans are so into the idea of JaVale McGee, is because he can be a defensive difference maker in the way that none of their other current guys can. So Dedman, I did not expect this at the time. I thought the Warriors did really well to get Zaza, and they did. You know, when you're talking about the three best guys designed for something, getting one of the three is certainly better than getting none of them, even if Pachulia has looked to be the weakest of them so far. But yeah, I would say Dedman, if I could do it over again, knowing what we know now, and pick who I thought would be best for this Golden State Warriors team, I would pick Dwayne Dedman, former Santa Cruz Warrior Dwayne Dedman. Next question. Exasperated Dreams, which I kind of like as a username. How's the Warriors off-ball movement compared to last year? It's just a little bit more limited. I think you're not seeing guys move as hard, move as much, and also the ball movement isn't there, and that sometimes can feed one another, because if the ball is really humming around, it gives the players additional motivation, because that means that if you're in your spot at the right time, if you beat your guy to the spot, the ball is going to be there, and they're not all the way there yet. It's going to take some time. You also have the idea that for this team that they want to kind of build their way into the playoffs, and every single player on this team saw what Cleveland did last year, that they, you know, really kicked it into another gear in the conference finals, and that changes the way you want to think about the regular season. It should. The Warriors don't need to push it, even if they got the 2 seed, which I don't expect. I expect them to get the 1. It wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. And so that kind of idea of just waiting, working at it to get it more crisp, and they're also figuring a lot more out. I mean, 2 new centers, an all-new central figure in Kevin Durant. Ian Clark is in a really different role. Even Sean Livingston is still figuring out some really different stuff. It's something I've focused on at The Athletic, is just how different his role is on this team, especially with the Durant stagger, than it was in the past. And once you start to figure that stuff out, once you get closer to the finish line and really start thinking about it, then I think a lot of that stuff will come along for the ride. And it is not concerning at all to me that it is worse and less crisp than it was before. That is the kind of the thing that you want to look at. Next question is from D. Moosens again, when asked a question before, and it was, how much do you think Andre Iguodala will be worth as a free agent next year, and how much do you think he will get? It does depend a little bit on how, kind of, if he looks done, if he looks older, but it only really matters to the point of if he wants to go somewhere else, or in terms of how much he can extract from the Warriors. So if we go on the assumption that the Warriors are going to be an over-the-cap team, they'll sign Durant, sign Curry that way, and then they'll be over for a while. The difference in Iguodala's money, assuming he wants to come back, is really just Lake Up and Goober's money, because that it's the luxury tax bill is really where it goes. And I think the more interesting question for him is, I think a lot of people will focus on the per year amount here, and, you know, I'd probably ballpark it in the new CBA as being somewhere in the 8 to 10 million per year range. But the more interesting question is going to be how many years they do, because you could see a very good argument for making it either a little bit less money for an extra year or two, or making it a little bit higher and then just having it be fewer. Maybe you have some sort of partial guarantee on that third year, depending on how much time he plays. And the reason for that is that you get yourself a little bit of protection in case he falls off, in case you get anything else. And Iguodala has already made a lot of money, so it's not a circumstance like that. So I would say something in the neighborhood of 3 years, $27 million, but it could go a little bit higher, a little bit lower. But then that number will probably drop precipitously if Durant wants to maximize his own salary and they have to use cap space, because then it gets a lot harder for Livingston, gets a lot harder for Iguodala. But I will save that for a very different time. I'm going to do the last question, which is pretty much the last one. There were a couple other ones that were kind of around it, but I think I tackled that in the eventual thing. And these are both from King Shindo. And the first one is, I know it's only December, which it's not, it's early November, but if the Warriors and Cavs match up in the finals, what do you think the Warriors' weaknesses are in their matchup, as in what can the Cavs expose, and how do you think KD fixes whatever woes the Warriors had in the last three games of last year's finals? I'll start with the second part first. What Durant does is he gives the Cavs defense another guy that they have to focus on. Last year, they could throw all of their resources at the Curry-Draymond pick and roll. That's why they ended up with the approach of putting LeBron on Draymond, kind of having him stifle that and then allowing him to kind of go back and freelance a little bit on defense. When the Warriors have Kevin Durant, you can't do that. You can't handle it the same way. You have to do a lot of things differently. What I would do with that, if they're going to try to take the same approach and try to make it, put LeBron on that pick and roll, just run the pick and roll with the opposite guy. And they're going to have Kevin Love probably on that player. You can't really switch it the same way unless Steph Curry sprains his MCL again. And that takes away a lot of it. What the Cavs will do to exploit the Warriors is they will abuse Golden State in pick and roll as long as they keep traditional big men in the game, because LeBron James and Kyrie Irving are both awesome in that kind of circumstance. You can't switch Zaza, David West, Kevon Looney onto those guys at this point in their career. So they will use that until they can't anymore. And it could actually be to their own detriment, because one of the things that I wrote a lot about after the finals and during the finals, and for those of you who listened to Dunked On, you'll remember this, is that Coach Kerr overly relied on his traditional big men, especially after Andrew Bogut went out. And so anything that convinces him that he shouldn't do that anymore might not be the best long-term idea for the Cavs. Of course, you can't really think that deep strategically, because your goal is to win games. And if you can steal a game before they figure that out, that's one fewer that you have to get before that. So that is something very important to consider and to kind of piece all of that together. And then the second part of King Shindo's question is, long-term, how do you see the defense unfolding? This ties in with a question that was asked on kind of the very beginning of the first one. And I think that when long-term, we're going to be dealing more with things like the death lineup. I think they will go very switch heavy. And they will also use Durant more as the kind of in what you could call the stereotypical Andre Iguodala role, which was that primary man-to-man defender on the opposing team's best perimeter scorer. Durant has done that in his career at various moments when they faced the Spurs in playoff series. Like, he handled Kawhi a lot when they beat them in the second round last year. And as Iguodala is aging a little bit, he's still a great help defender, but he's getting a little bit worse in man-to-man, especially against the most physically gifted guys in the league. So Durant can buy him a buffer in that way. Against teams that are have a more limited perimeter scorer, if you want to call it a swingman scorer, meaning a two or a three, you can use Iguodala there, and then that opens up Durant as a help defender, which is what he was best at in the series against the Warriors in the Western Conference Finals and other things. So it will really depend on the matchup. And I think the interesting example of that, the kind of the duality, would be, so for the Clippers, you probably put Durant on Blake Griffin or DeAndre Jordan, and then you have put Andre on whoever they started the three, which has been Luke Richard and Bob Mute, but you can go different directions. But maybe against the Utah Jazz, if it's them, or the Spurs, you put Durant on Hayward or Kawhi, and then you put Iguodala somewhere else, presumably on the power forward. And so they'll do different things there, and part of the reason why all that matters is also because the hope for Coach Kerr and the Warriors has to be that they will use their advantages offensively by going in those small lineups to try to force the other team's bigs off the floor. And most other teams don't have enough smalls to keep track of the Warriors to really make it up. So, like, you can think about Utah as one of the only teams that can really do that they can slide in Joe Johnson instead of Gobert or Favors, however they want to do it. But by and large, you know, like, the Clippers don't have just like an excess of wings if they play Blake or DeAndre off the floor. They're kind of going to have to play big ball the whole way through. And Cleveland is the same way, especially if Iman Shumpert can't really deliver this year, and they're going to have to deal with that, because having Kevin Durant is a fundamental change, and it changes the way that teams have to defend the Warriors. So that's a lot to do. Thank you so much for all these questions. There are even a couple more that I could have hit, but I think they overlapped a little bit with everything that happened. Feedback was amazing. It seems like people have enjoyed these. I will try to do them with some frequency. Ballparking it at every 2 to 3 weeks would be something. Might try some different formats, try some different things, but I have really enjoyed it. So thanks so much to r/Warriors, the Reddit community, for everything like this, for giving a great mix of kind of fun questions, substantive questions, easy questions, hard questions, because that's what makes this fun for me and hopefully what makes it an engaging product for you. You can follow up, you can kind of give your input on the show. You can reach out to me, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com, Danny LaRue on Twitter, DannyLaRueX. I read everything, respond to what I can. It's best if you want feedback in that way to send it via email, because with Twitter, sometimes you miss things, especially during games. I get a lot of stuff in my mentions and everything like that with everything that's going on, but you can do whatever makes you happy. If you want to support the show, you can go to download it wherever you want to. You can subscribe wherever you want to, whatever podcast player you like. You can use Audioboom. You can use iTunes. You can use Stitcher. You can use TuneIn. And something else that's big that you can do to help is if there is a podcast player that we aren't on for whatever reason, you can let me know. The one exception to that is Google Play. I am very aware of that. There are some reasons that I do not want to get into on this podcast for why we are not on that at the moment. That could very well change with time, but that one I'm aware of. I don't need information that we're not on Google Play. I know that one for sure. But anything you do with that, you can leave a rating, leave a review, and whatever you want to use. And all of that kind of goes to the idea of giving other people a way to connect with the show, and also sponsors letting them know that you're really engaged with everything. And I'm so appreciative of all the support that we've already gotten so far. And another thing you can do to help out is to check out our sponsors. I did a live read in the business for SeatGeek yesterday, but you can still use the discount even if you didn't listen to that show. You download their app, you go and use the promo code LOWARRIORS, and that gives you $20 off your first order. You get a free $20. You get to use a cool app that I personally use and enjoy, and you get to tell them that you came from us. So it really is a win-win-win, and I hope you use that. I hope you enjoy it. So thank you so much, everybody. I hope those of you who are eligible to vote voted, whatever your affiliation. It is an amazing privilege that we have. Take care, and make it a great day.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.